The name of tonight's presentation is When is Love Real? There is so many situations where we apply the term love. I love my wife, I love my children, I love my dog, I love my mother-in-law, I love my... And we hope it's not the same love for the pet as it is for some of the extended members of the family. But we throw the word around so often. Is it possible that in my love for the Knicks and the Mets and for soccer and all the other loves we might have, art, culture, music, that this word could possibly lose the sensitivity that's contained in the power of love? So we're going to search tonight for a clarity and identify when is love real, when is it not real. In a certain sense, I want to dedicate tonight's presentation to Ringo Starr. I was about 16 years old when I was walking into school one day. I was in an unusual school. A lot of parents were famous actors and actresses. And Ringo Starr, he had a son in the school. His son was Zach, many years younger than myself. He was about 4 or 5 years old at the time. Today he's almost as famous as his father's, in and out of rehab and prisons across America. But at that time, this cute little boy, Zach, Ringo walks into school holding his hand, and he came out of a bright green Rolls Royce. He had a long green sheepskin coat. And I go up to Ringo, I say, Ringo, can I have your autograph? And he says two words to me. The second word was off. And the first word had four letters and it was not love. And I was saying to myself, you know, here's a guy, here he is, he's drumming away, love is all you need, yeah, 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 yeah. You don't know the first word. Where's your decency? And tell me, as another human being, look, your therapist told you, your career's in your wrist, you can't keep on these signatures. I would understand. But here I am, 16 years old, he was about up to here on me. You have to remember, he was a very short gentleman and... He was wearing stilts, you know, those high heels. It's come back into fashion now with platforms and high heels. And if he told me, I would have picked him. Okay, I'm sorry. I say to myself, you know what, where do we go for love? I'll never forget, my father was working on a film. My father, the introduction was made, my father's well known in the film industry. He's the best in the world in revoicing. That's dubbing, revoicing films. He did all the old James Bond films, Sean Connery and Roger Moore. He directed the revoicing on all those films. I don't say that to impress you. I just want to show you where I'm coming from when I give you certain examples. On one occasion, he was revoicing with Elizabeth Taylor. And he was directing her. She was carried into the studio 2 hours after the studio was already booked. She was carried in by the porter of the Ritz Hotel. And he gave the explanation that she couldn't get a word out of her, that she'd been drinking since 3 a.m. She got off the phone at 3 a.m. with Richard Burton. At that time, she was married to him for the third time. And obviously, the conversation didn't go too well because now she was totally out of control. And they couldn't get one word out of her. And I ask you, is it not true? And I'm not interested in putting down Ringo Starr or Elizabeth Taylor or anyone else, but my simple question is, not a valuation, just an observation. When we look around us, is it not possible that our children often see people who are held up as idols to worship, whether it's rock stars, whether they are actors or actresses, and we ask ourselves the question, have they found real love in their lives, or is it possible for the amount of love we have for them, they still feel very lonely and have not found themselves? The average number of times an actor and actress is married is about 3 times plus. How many times was Liz married, by the way?
Eight.
Six, seven, eight. Hey, nine. Yeah. Actually, it was a nine. That's correct. Nine is the correct number on my last count. Liz is married 9 times. Now, would you assume that with 9 marriages, this is a lot of experience in love, would you say that she must have something to say on this subject? So, about 2 years ago, she recovered from a brain tumor operation. It was successful. And she was asked, Liz, could you please tell us, what do you think of Sean Connery? And she said, Sean Connery, he can put his slippers beneath my bed any night of the week. Mrs. Sean Connery, you're not here, are you? No. Okay. Liz, Let me ask you, what is loyalty on a scale of 0 to 10? How important, how valuable is loyalty in a love relationship? If you were to give it a rating, what rating would it score?
9.
10? 12? You broke the scale? Loyalty is very high. Liz, what are you saying in terms of, I'm not putting down Liz, I'm asking a very simple question. Someone has gone through what she went through in terms of 9 marriages and all the pain and the pleasures, and now has an opportunity to share with us something meaningful about love. Is this the comment that we have to hear? Where are we supposed to go? And I'll ask another question. Don't get me wrong, I love Shakespeare. I love Macbeth, The Tempest. But, you know, if we were to ask ourselves, here is someone who has deep, insightful understanding of relationships, the human dynamic, true or false? Absolutely true. If we were to ask ourselves, which play would we analyze to have a deeper understanding of love, if we were to go to any one of his plays, which one would we probably choose? Probably Romeo and Juliet. And what is the message there? If you can't have the one that you love, you kill yourself. Now, it's a kind of tragedy because when they eloped and they tried to get away without the parents finding out, she took poison to feign that she was dead, but really she was alive, she was going to come through. And when Romeo comes to the scene and finds that she's dead, when she really wasn't but didn't know, what does he do? He takes his life. And when she wakes up and finds what her husband just did, she goes and takes hers. Now, I don't say that is not a reflection of reality. People do take their lives when they see that they can't have the one they love. But let me ask you, in real life, what do we want as a message that's going to support us in understanding when is love real? There are only 2 billion other males or females out there to choose from. Is it only this one that can ever work for me? Where do we search, where do we go for clarity on love? We are told by our sages in a book called Orchot Tzadikim, The Ways of the Righteous, that of all the personality traits that exist in the entire gamut of human dynamics, there is not one trait that has the power that love has to build or destroy. There is nothing that can stand up to love. The expression given is Ahava dohe et hakol. Love can force anything and everything. If we take this statement seriously, if we take it literally, what we are really saying is that no matter how far a child has fallen away in the relationship from mum or from dad, if we can touch, if we can hook in, click on real love, we're being told, Ava dohe takol, real love can force any change. That it's never too late. The question we're going to look at tonight, in many different scenarios, love for parents, love for children, love for oneself, love for money, love for pleasures, we're going to ask ourselves in each scenario, when is it real, when is it not real? And ask, if I can click more into, if I can hook into, if I can connect more with the real love, what might it do to the love I need more for myself and in my relationships, in my marriage, with my children, perhaps even in my career and for extended family? The Chafetz Chaim, one of the saintly sages of the last century, even made the statement in one of his works called Shmirat HaLashon, which describes the importance of being sensitive in not hurting other people with one's words, describes that love is so powerful that if there were 10 Jews anywhere in history that would have abundant love on the real level that we're trying to describe tonight, it would bring the Messiah. How accurate that is, not accurate, but as a concept alone, what's being posed to us is that love dohe et hakol, it has the power to overcome everything. How about a broken marriage? Is it possible that if I can somehow reclaim the love for the virtues that I saw when we were engaged? The virtues that when mom or dad or whoever else said, listen, I don't think this is going to work. And I said, no, you're wrong. I love her. I love him. And that love was so strong, it was so clear, and even if it was blind, we told ourselves, I'm committed all the way. I don't care what everyone else says. I'm sure it's going to work. Is there a possibility that where, God forbid, love in a marriage has become eroded through time, We've tried to communicate and it hasn't always worked. And as the weeks, months and years, perhaps even decades go by, we suddenly find ourselves more and more apart, more distance. Is there a way to reclaim the love in the marriage, start dating again? Perhaps even re-adopt some of the small ingredients that we're going to look at in the love potion, the love ingredients of smile, hug, a simple kiss. We're going to look carefully at each one of those because maybe the love formula is not so complicated. Respect, loyalty, sensitivity, empathy, gratitude, appreciation. What's now been coined as the emotional IQ, in Hebrew we call it midot tovot, the measures, the positive measures of a personality trait that equal the love relationship. Love is the empathy, the sensitivity, appreciation, understanding, gratitude, respect, loyalty, trust. Very deep virtues, very deep virtues. Is it possible they really do exist in each one of us? But sometimes things get in the way and we start looking at the faults and lose focus on the possibility that those love ingredients are there anymore. Is it possible we can still reclaim them? How about the power of real love to heal oneself from depression or even suicide? Is it possible that I have lost being in contact of the virtues that are who I really am, and now I'm so convinced that I'm good for nothing, that my wife doesn't love me, my children have no respect for me, my parents don't appreciate me, and my boss, I can't believe, I've been busting my tail for him in the last 10 years. I've been doing the job of 3 employees and I still haven't got the raise that I deserve. And I go to the doctor and he tells me I'm a candidate for heart disease and cancer. And I'm saying to myself, I've got nothing to live for. And I don't love myself the way I should. And I'm not taking care of my body, my hygiene, or my self-respect. Is it possible that by redefining real love, that I can perhaps overcome depression and turn myself around so that the people who are in my life are not responding to the same me? And in responding to a different me, with a different self-respect, self-esteem, self-love, perhaps respond differently. And so, in effect, do we really change anybody in our lives? Or when we change ourselves, we change the way others respond to us? But let's ask ourselves honestly, I think most of us are married in this room. Is there anyone here who knows that they have managed to change their spouse by forcing them? No hands up? No, you don't have to be so obvious in public, but does anyone ever change anyone by forcing them? And if we do, is it outward or is it inward change? No, it's outward change. It's not real change. And we're talking about really connecting. Is it possible that the power of real love for our Creator can transcend any adversity? Is it possible that real love for the virtue of a great ideal has been so strong in the heart, mind, and emotion of a person that they can transcend any adversity for the love of that ideal? So we're going to start looking more and more at how the power of real love can transcend literally anything and even change around anything. So it gives back the power to ourselves to give love to ourselves and to others to change where we want to change the love relationship, whether it's our marriage or with our children or extended members of the family or those closest to us in our lives that we really do want a connection and a relationship with. How about the love for money? Is it possible that real love for money allows us to overcome any desire to cheat or steal or to earn in a dishonest way, so that we can feel not only secure in the integrity, the power and principles of integrity that we live by, and that the money we've earned is honest, but then all money that's left over after we've paid our bills, we can contribute and help family, community, and beyond? The power of love for money has the power to change the quality and comfort of our lives. So I'm going to ask the simple question, what is the barometer What is the measure, the definition of real love? And I'm going to suggest it's an awareness of which direction the love is going in. Is my intent to have love in my life an intent to get love or to give love? And we're going to ask ourselves, can we take this formula of either looking to get love or looking to give love and see how it applies in different situations, perhaps even get a clarity on when giving love to get love and not getting it when I was giving so much makes me feel that I've been giving so much in this relationship and I'm not getting back what I would expect by the law of reciprocation. Maybe we need to re-examine my definition of giving love. Is my reason that I want to give you love so that you will love me? And then we have to ask the question, are you going to notice that? That if I'm telling you, I can't believe it's taken this many years, you still don't fully appreciate me. I tell you, when you start loving me, you have no idea how much love there is waiting to burst out. Wait a minute. If I make my happiness dependent on you, not you personally, man, but if I make my happiness dependent on you changing in your relationship with me and being more appreciative and understanding and empathetic of me, who have I given the power to in this relationship? And who am I making responsible for changing in the marriage or with the kid? If I make you responsible, and I'm making you the one who owns the power to change the love, because when you start loving me and appreciating me and trusting me and stop nagging me, then I will be much more loving in response. What I've essentially done is given you all the power, and I'm also saying, I'm not responsible. You change, then I will change. But unfortunately, what is the reality? I come out of high school and I say, you know what? I can't wait. When I get my exams finished, I'll be so happy. You know that experience, right? But when I get my first relationship, I'll be so happy. When I get out of this relationship, I'll be so happy. You know, when I get my first job, I'll be so, when I get out of this job, I'm going to be so happy. You know, when I get married, I'll be so, when I get divorced, I'll be so happy. You know, when I have kids, I'll be so happy. You know, when I get the kids out of the house, I'll be so happy. See, every time I make love in my life, happiness in my life, fulfillment in my life dependent on my boss or my bank account or my lifestyle, or another person, even it be my spouse or my children, I've really said, how much am I willing to invest responsibility from myself to make the change that's needed? If I'm saying that when you change, when the circumstances change, when the career opportunity or the job changes or the boss changes, then I can have love, fulfillment, pleasure and happiness in my life. We need to look for definition of love that it's going to be about me changing me. Because as long as I'm stuck with any other definition, I'm going to cause endearment or resentment in the person that I'm expecting reciprocation from. I'm going to make you resent me. Especially when I reveal that I've been giving so much and expecting something in return, and it's not happening. I know it's easy to patronize and it's easy to talk about unconditional love, but I'm going to go through many examples that we can relate to in our own lives and ask ourselves again and again, where is the love? In which direction is it going in? And what's attached to it? Let's look at love for myself. I think that's the best place to start. Let's look at my own love for me. Is my love for me measured by how much others love me? I'll give you a very simple scenario. Your daughter comes home one day and she's crying. Your 5-6-year-old daughter, Sarah, what's the matter?
Mommy, Jeremy, next door said, I'm ugly and I'm unintelligent.
Is it true? Are you stupid? Are you ugly?
No.
Oh, I'm very glad to hear that. Sarah, what's more important? What Jeremy thinks about you or what you think about you? What's more important? How you look at the beauty inside and outside of yourself, or what others say your beauty is. Bringing to our children not a lecture, but the clarity of them being in control of their definition of themselves. That if someone tells them they're not intelligent, what's their personal reference? what's their frame of reference, that they then integrate that comment versus how they know about themselves. I'll give you a very simple analogy shared by a great Kabbalist from last century, the Ben Ish Chai, very famous Sephardic Kabbalist, who gives a simple but profound analogy of a gentleman, we'll call him Joe, who invests his money in a golden bowl, let's say $100,000. And he is so pleased that he's managed to buy this antique golden bowl. He brings it home, and on his way, he meets a friend of his who works in precious gems, silver, gold, and says, oh, let me look at your antique bowl. Looks at it and says, there's a very large amount of copper in here. You do realize this is probably worth about $60,000. The man's devastated. He's made a tremendous loss. What a fool he's made of himself. And he goes home, and he falls into a depression. He had been dreaming of investing in this bowl. It would become worth so much more in the future. And now he's told by someone he knows in the business that it's only worth $60,000. He's devastated. And his children see him upset. Friends come over, tell jokes, try to cheer him up. Nothing doing. He's rocking backwards and forwards in his chair, depressed. Finally, a certain wise person, a friend of his, turns up at the door, asks to see the bowl, takes out a scale, some measures, goes over to our friend Joe and says, Joe, I want you to know something. I checked out this bowl. I'm in the business 23 years. And I can tell you that if you're willing, I'll pay you $500,000 for this bowl. Its gold value is 99%. The amount of copper in here is negligible. And its antique value is way beyond what you paid for it. Will you give me the bowl? And Joe is ecstatic. What's the difference between this statement and the previous statements of those who try to cheer him up? And when he explained to his children what happened, he said, when all my friends came to tell me jokes and cheer me up, essentially what they were really saying is that I was right, I was a fool, I made a ridiculous mistake in buying this bowl. But when this other person came, and he's an expert, he revealed the true value of the bowl. That's what made me realize what I had, what I owned. So says the Ben Ish Chai, self-esteem is self-estimation of true worth. And that when I am depressed, I'm not talking about medical depression, when I'm depressed because of mistakes or my own estimation of myself, it's a miscommunication of true value. The true intrinsic virtue of what a human being really is way beyond what we will ever demonstrate. How many times adversity has squeezed out of us forces, strength, loyalty, ability to love and have compassion that was way beyond anything we had demonstrated in our track record, in any relationship. So our true value may not yet even be fully discovered. So how much we love ourselves depends on what others have said or what we say of ourselves. How many times we look at famous people, people with many letters at the end of their name, people with high positions in the corporate world, and yet, is it possible they could have low self-esteem? What went wrong? Great careers, famous, recognized, could be adored and loved by millions of people, and yet in their own personal self-estimation, feel like a nothing. And we see it every day. Loving myself is becoming aware of the true virtues of who I am and who I want to become. And I may not have fully demonstrated those, but they are nevertheless intrinsic. I want to move on to love of children, though there's much more to say on self-esteem, but children have a big piece in this because we were all children at one time, so we can all relate to this one way or another. Why do we love giving to our children? We love kissing them, cuddling them. Now, I can't say it's pleasant to change their diaper, but we love them being clean and happy, and there is, and I'm seeing some nods here, even from possibly grandparents, that changing your child's diaper gives you pleasure. Why? Did you ever had one kid whose diaper was changed that gave you one solitary thank you? It never happened. What is the purpose of giving and giving and giving to this child? And we carry on giving.
They can hold it over their head.
Yeah. There. To give them a guilt trip, that's one possibility. What is the purpose of giving? You know, in Hebrew, it makes me feel good. Okay, that I'm doing the best as that I possibly can as a parent for this child, and that I'm providing all the child's needs for what eventual purpose? I love my child, that's absolutely true. And what is the purpose even beyond that, though? What is the greatest love I'm going to really enjoy, the Jewish nachas, the pleasure that we're really looking for? What's the greatest Jewish nachas that we want to be able to say about our child?
That they'll love you.
That they love us too? Absolutely. Their self-esteem? You're absolutely right, and I'm not making you wrong in my search for one particular word, which I think you'll agree encompasses it all. Sorry? Grow up to be a mensch, absolutely. That's definitely part of it.
Self-love is very secure about themselves when they learn from their environment.
When they're loved at home, the environment which I assume you're referring to, they grow up secure, and then because they have been loved, they're more secure in their giving of love. They're more trusting in their giving of love. I'm going to ask you a question. What is the Hebrew language called in Hebrew? Ivrit, that's modern Hebrew, but what is the biblical language known as? When we refer to biblical Hebrew, what do we call it? We call it Lashon HaKodesh, the Holy Tongue. Why do we call it Holy Tongue? Because the claim is that the words in Hebrew are the words that created the physical universe. That what preceded physical reality, when we look at Genesis, God's words spoke and created the physical universe. So according to that claim, the words preceded creation. The letters and combination of letters in the Hebrew language are the building blocks of reality. If that's true, then when we look at a specific word, we're going to discover the reality from God's mindset, so to speak. When we look at the word forgiving in Hebrew, gomel, to nurture, to give, to cause to grow, it's an interesting three-letter root, because the same word, gomel, also means to stop giving. Because in Genesis chapter 21, when Sarah weaned her child, the expression there is v'yigamal. She stopped giving milk to her child. So the question obviously is, God, you have unlimited imagination. Why would you choose one word which means giving and it also means to stop giving? Contained in this word is the secret of all parenting. The purpose of giving is in order to give and give and give so that the child will become independent, able to give to themselves. They'll be a mensch for themselves and for others. They'll be loving to themselves and to others, financially responsible for themselves and for others. Teaching our children, loving our children, giving to our children is with the goal to make them independent. It's usually about 38, 40 years old. I mean 18 years old. sorry. I didn't mean to be so real. Teaching our children to love themselves from the love that we give to them is all about giving in order that they can give for themselves. Let us ask the question, what happens if at the same time that I love my child, I berate him when he comes home with a bad school report card? Is it possible that the child gets the impression, the reason I'm really loved is because when I'm doing well in school, but when I'm not, I'm a failure? Is it possible that even in the school system, without any written policy, teachers, even peers, and sometimes parents and grandparents, are giving accolades to the kids based on grades and the school report card? And yet let us ask the simple question, in the reality of real life, and let's define that, marriage, real life, raising children, real life, earning a living, what is the greater measure of happiness and feeling love and feeling loved in real life? The corporate position we get because of the degrees and the schools we went to? The job, the career, the salary, the commissions, the car I drive, the lifestyle I live? And I'm not degrading or denigrating lifestyle. I'm just asking, when we put things into perspective, which of these two is going to be the real measure of feeling happiness and love in our lives? Is it going to be the report card? Or is it going to be how we get along with ourselves and others? The emotional IQ, the midot tovot, the personality traits that make up the love relationship of affection, appreciation, respect, loyalty, sensitivity, empathy, listening, deeper listening, understanding the other person's pain, understanding their aspirations. And even if I don't share the same joys that you have and same hobbies and aspirations you have, but because you are in my life, I'm happy for you. And we find a way to make the differences, not destroy the respect, not destroy the love. So the question isn't, is my child going in the way I want him to? In which case the child gets clearly, even though they can't describe how they feel till they're much older, the child hears, the reason why you love me is because I'm doing well in school, but when I'm not. Or the reason why you love me is because when I dress this way, then it's okay, but when I wear polka dots and you don't like the hairstyle or my choice of friends, suddenly it's not the same love. What happens when real love is turned on? Real love, and it's hard many times for us to hear it, real love is not related to performance. Real love is, as you were saying, is because you're my child. My goal is also that you benefit by becoming independent, self-serving, self-efficient, and you're able to give love for yourself and others because you've been nurtured in such a loving environment as our home. But that's not what the love is about. Because when I attach love to your intelligence, why can't you be like your older brother, Jimmy? He applies himself so... He's so disciplined. Your sister is so neat and tidy. Look at her room. What am I doing when I make those statements? Am I clicking into real love, or am I making my love dependent on something? That when that something is there, I love my kid, and when it's not, my kid does not feel my love. Is it possible that if I make a few hundred thousand statements like that in a childhood's history, that the child gets the impression that mom or dad hates them? Could it be that a kid turns around, is a teenager, and says, "Mom, you hate me. I, what? Hate you? Are you nuts? I had you in my womb 9 months. Did you know what? I went through with labor 3 months, sleepless nights, just keeping you awake. I hate you. I cooked for you 9,000 meals before you could boil an egg. I changed 8,000 diapers before you were potty trained. I went and took a second job so I could give you a higher education. I hate you." "Yeah, Mum, you do hate me. Where did I go wrong?" And the answer is, if my kid doesn't get that I love you anyway, even when the report card isn't what it, even when you're not dressing, even when you're not speaking the way I like you, I still love you no matter what. That is unconditional. That is the love that says to the child, my mom, my dad's going to love me anyway. When the child gets a kiss and a smile every time they come home, and even if it's not every time, but most times, a kiss and a hug and a smile, those three alone are the most powerful messages of love. Because a smile says, I'm happy. You exist in my life. Is it possible that my child, who I'm busting my tail, putting in all those extra hours at work to put money aside for their future education and possibly beyond, that I could come home, beeper, is that my pilot? Oh no, it's my cellular. And then I'm so busy with answering the email and the voicemail and the correspondence that when my kid walks into the house, I walk right by, and she doesn't exist. Could that happen a few hundred thousand times? And yet all that we're asking is, when I smile, my she. Oh, you're home! What a pleasure! No more than that! Even if dad is so busy, he doesn't get to spend more than a few seconds kissing, hugging, but just recognizes Moshe exists in his life. Is it possible that with all the mistakes dad could make and all the mistakes mom could make, that kiss, that smile, and that hug were still said, done so many times that the child got it? That when dad's disappointed, mom's disappointed with the report card, or the choice of friends, or the choice of career, or the irresponsibility, or the bedroom not being the way it, or the relationships they're getting in, but they get the love. Is it possible that that love is the seed planted in the soil of rapport that allows for the child to turn around later on. But what happens if the child feels resentful? Because mom and dad keep telling me they love me, but I get this feeling that it's dependent on my performance. That's when they really love me. They're so devastated when I don't perform, or when I don't dress, or I don't choose the friends or career that they want me to go in, that, you know what, I feel resentment. I feel resentful because they don't love me. They want me to be like them, and then they'll love me. So it's not me that they love. It's my performance to their definition of who I should be that they love. And when I'm not that, they don't love me. And then if I get myself in trouble, God forbid, I won't listen to my parents later on. It'll be much harder. Because the real love is an investment, not just in the now. That kiss, that hug, and that smile, even if I don't spend a whole lot of time, even if I don't play with my kids when they were young, even if I didn't take them out on that many trips and I didn't get to build much of a communication, but the love and the kiss and hug alone could be the seeds that plant the seeds of rapport later on that can create the relationship so that the child will want to have the healing relationship they want to make up for the years lost. And we're told that a child is intrinsically, umbilically related to mom and dad, not only emotionally, spiritually. They will always want a relationship with mom and dad, no matter what. Even when a lot has gone between them and they don't want to talk with mom and dad, they still want it later on. So when we're talking about love for our children, we're talking about it's not hanging on their performance, their clothes, wardrobe, the way they keep their room. And I'm not saying I can't give them instruction. I can't. No, of course I have to give them guidelines of what they can and can't do, when they can borrow the car, when they can't, what my suggestion of how they should dress. But it has to be that I give them the opening of, you choose after I've given you the choice. This is my version. This is my voice. Now it's your choice. I'm trusting you to make your choices, even though they don't agree with mine. But I'll love you no matter what. One child, 3 years old, was told every night before she goes to sleep by her daddy, I love you no matter what, my dear princess. She heard this hundreds of times. 3 years old, she one day says to daddy, Daddy, what do you mean you love me no matter what? What does no matter what mean? Princess, no matter what means, even when you don't listen to mommy, and even when you don't listen to daddy, we still love you, no matter what. That's what no matter what means. It's not hanging on performance, even though sometimes that performance really gets under our skin and beyond. But the child needs to know that it's real love, no matter what. There's more to say on this, but I'm going to move along. Love of money. Love of money is famously called the root of all evil. It can cause me to lie, to cheat. It can cause me to badmouth and humiliate the competition at every opportunity. It can cause me to live with constant thoughts of jealousy. That when I look and see what someone else has that I haven't got, my definition of happiness becomes defined by what I haven't yet got. That's not a definition of happiness, that's unhappiness. That's what the entire media plays into. All advertising works on the formula, on the assumption, I can't possibly be fulfilled, happy, until I'm buying, drinking, smoking, driving, wearing, eating, dieting, this version. It's all on an assumption that I'm not happy now. And it eats away at my true definition for finding happiness in my life. The love for money can destroy me, but it can also be an amazing asset that we pay our bills and paying our way through life, the integrity, the honesty of knowing that we did it ourselves. And let me ask you honestly, when we love money and we want to buy something that we want and we don't have enough money for it, what do we do? Credit cards! Yes! Now let me ask you, we're talking about real definitions here. When I used to work in advertising with my father, I used to work with Saatchi & Saatchi. I want to share with you, what is a credit card? In reality, we're asking for real love. What's a real credit card? What is a credit card? What's its real identity? It's a debt card. Yes. In fact, what was life insurance called before it was called life insurance? Death insurance, that's right. Someone comes to your door. Hello? I'm selling death insurance and accessories. Are you interested? Death? No, thank you. Death? We changed it to life insurance. Credit cards are not credit cards, they're debt cards. Now let me ask you, you've been pre-approved, madam. Your name is?
Ina.
Ina, you've been pre-approved for $5,000 additional credit over and above other credits you previously haven't. If you apply before March the 30th, you will get a special rate of 5.9% interest over and above prime rate in small print. Are you interested in applying?
No, thank
you. How about $20,000?
I don't need it.
Oh, you don't need it? Okay, fine.
But thank you.
Okay, Ina, you know what? Let's call it what it really is. Ina, you've been pre-approved for $20,000 debt over and above all other debts you previously have. Now, if you apply for more debt right now before March the 30th, you'll get a special rate of 5.9% interest plus prime rate over and above all. Are you interested in more debt? No? How about $50,000 debt? No one signing? Oh, let's call it credit. What did our parents or grandparents do when they didn't have enough money to buy what they wanted?
They didn't buy it.
They didn't buy it. Or? They saved. Or?
They went without.
Well, they went without. They might have sacrificed some other area which they felt was of less value. Sorry? Or they found a way to pay in installments if it was that important. And today, we have the great privilege of credit cards. That means I can now buy and live a lifestyle that I can't afford. What a wonderful feeling! According to Dr. Mark Hegstead, in his report to the Senate on health and fitness in America, and I quote almost verbatim, there is mounting evidence that in some cases suggests and in others proves that lifestyle, financial pressure, and diet and health are directly responsible and correlated to the two biggest killers in America today, heart disease and cancer. Is it possible that the plastic version of love for money, not the real version, when we buy from what we've earned, when we spend less than we earn and invest the difference, instead of spending more than I'm earning, is it possible that could create financial pressure in my life that could spill over into less time for family, more pressure in the relationship, in the marriage, less time for my kids, and then affect my health? And it's not even a wild story. It's not in the imagination. We see it all the time. We've got the wrong definition of love for money. Love for money means the pleasure of spending less than we earn, living within our means. And I'll ask you a question. If you had the choice that your child could have abundant wealth, a check, let's say $5 million a year, cash in their account for the rest of their lives, would you choose that as option one or option two? They would always make decisions about money based on financial responsible principles. Which would you prefer, that they be financially responsible or abundantly wealthy? You'd want both. It's question. Of course we want both, but I'll ask you. Of course we want both. But I'll ask you, which of the two is more likely to make us enjoy our wealth, maintain it, and even build it? Which of the two?
Financial
responsibility. So we know the reality that love for money is based on principles, not for what money will give us, but what it will allow us to give because we've got it. Which direction is the love going in? Am I giving to my child because of what I'm going to get back? Am I giving with money because of what I'm going to get back? Or am I into the relationship with money because of what money will allow me to give to myself and others in my life? To feed my family, to give others who don't have, to take care of extended members of the family, perhaps give them opportunities they would not have otherwise had, because I have money, not just paying them out a free check, but to give them connections, openings, so that they can move ahead in their lives. Number four, love for women. This is a very heavy one. We're told love for women can twist the mind of a male, so it changes love into lust. And lust is about loving me. It's not about loving you. Which direction is my love going in? Is it that I'm interested in you being interested in me? Or I'm interested in you because you are beautiful outside, inside? Where is my love coming from and where is it going to? The power that women have in their adorability, in their body, and their appeal, and their compassion, their devotion is way beyond a male's ability to give. No matter what, ask your wives, ask your mother-in-laws, ask your mothers, is it not true that the intrinsic, instinctive devotion that the woman has for her male partner, that the intrinsic, instinctive devotion that the woman has for her male partner is far deeper and more understanding intrinsically in their nature than the male has it in their own nature. So our sages tell us that true love for a woman is based on their true virtues. What are the true virtues that we're referring to? If a man is not connected to the real love in the relationship, is it possible that he will give second glances to another woman? Even undress them in his mind? Or look at magazines, photos, and movies that will be there to excite him, where he's not getting the love that he should be giving? And what does that lead to? Only more destruction in the family and society. The power of the love for women, the media has deliberately taken, and I'm sharing this not from the Talmud, I'm sharing it right from the world of advertising. They've taken the power that the woman has and they have deliberately portrayed it according to its real definition or the plastic one. Look at fashion. Look at Calvin Klein. It's not on tape. Calvin Klein ads. Brilliant concept. Black and white still photos. You know how much money they saved on full color processing? Black and white still photos depicting two messages. Real love? No. It's about to happen. Or it just did. Now, when you look, no, not you, sir. No, when you know someone who next looks at a Calvin Klein, how do you know, Rabbi? Listen, you're driving in Manhattan, you stop at the red light, and the bus passes in front of you. When you next see someone who looks at a Calvin Klein ad, ask them, what are these two messages? Who are they relating to? And what is the message about? Is it real love? Or is it taking something that has a reality to it, but attaching the wrong emphasis? And is it possible that those two messages, it's about to happen, or it just did, relates to a few hundred thousand, million youth who are frustrated, they don't have a physical partner in their lives on a consistent basis? Is this a portrayal of real love, or is this only skin deep? Look at the fashions. I'll never forget, as a 9-year-old, walking with my father in Earl's Court. Earl's Court is the Javits Center of London, and all the big conventions, and there I used to go to the annual motor show. Beautiful, gorgeous sports cars. I could never figure out this young woman, about 16 years old, in a suggestive position, sitting in a bikini on top of a sports car. And every sports car had this. You know, and I went to my father and said, Dad, you know what, if you write out a check for the car, do you get the. What's she doing on top of the car? London is not known for Californian weather. And the answer is they're not selling cars. They're selling expectations of what's going to happen when a person buys or lives this lifestyle. Newport, alive with pleasure. You see that big billboard? You see a woman being catapulted into a man's arms that by smoking Newport, alive with pleasure. If you're not smoking Newport, you're dead with pain. Smoke Newport and a woman's going to be catapulted into. Real or plastic? It's plastic. So where are they coming from? Who are they selling to? intelligent, discerning people. We've got masters, degrees, doctorates. I mean, who do they think we are? And what do you think Saatchi and Saatchi in their heyday, when they were asked, do you really believe people are buying your products because of your commercials? Do you know what their true answer was?
Yes.
You'd be surprised. Their honest answer was, we don't care if you don't buy our product because of our commercial. Because you will anyway. What? How do you know? And the answer is, how many commercials has the average child seen before the age of 10 in Western civilization? About 250,000 commercials. 250,000 times a child saw a true, real, or false plastic definition for love, happiness, pleasure, being associated with lifestyle and products instead of the intrinsic virtues of who a human being really is. Is it any wonder that kids grow up confused about when is love real? Money is there to teach us how to enjoy what we earn in order that we can improve our quality of life for a higher purpose and for giving for others. But where it's giving to myself and giving to myself and I see others have got and I want more for myself, what am I teaching myself in the love relationship to the material world around me? When we love our wives, we're told, what is the intrinsic virtues? There was one rabbi in the Talmud, I think it's in Yibamot, it was one of the names of the tractate, page 63, who had a very difficult relationship. His wife was not appreciative of her husband, and yet he was extremely loving and respectful. And when challenged by his own children, Dad, you know, you got a lot of patience for Mum, why don't you just divorce her? That's what he said. And you know what his answer was? Dayenu! Shigad leinu et baneinu, matzileinu menachet. You don't understand, my dear kids. Mom has two virtues alone that are so powerful, it forces everything out of the arena. These two virtues alone are so powerful, nothing else counts. Even if she would be abusive or disrespectful or unappreciative, I don't care. And what are those two virtues? The fact that they raise the kids, they're the ones who take burden, responsibility. It's enormous! If we had to give birth to children, we would not be having more than one child. It's so painful, and not just talking about the physical pain, and then want another. Men couldn't do it. It's a fact. Wouldn't be up to it. It's not a physical pain. They just haven't got the internal stamina to go through what the women go through. Dayenu shigad leinu et baneinu. It's enough they raise the children and what they go through in Sar Gilbonim, the pain of bringing up a child, it's not easy. And the women are much more involved and devoted than the husbands who were out building up our careers. Umatzileinu minachet, and they save a husband from looking at other women and thinking that they might get a better deal somewhere else. The wife has the power that in the intimacy of marriage, because they make themselves available to each other and don't use that area as leverage against each other, that is what makes the routine of marriage continue. I'll give you a more specific example. If God's angry with us, does he then say, that's it! Tomorrow, no gravity! Right! Forget about sunshine for a week! No! He did that once and he never did it again. That's right, he did it in chapter 6 in Genesis. And in chapter 8 he said, I'll never do it again. To teach us the lesson, if you do it once, don't do it again. He's teaching us a lesson just as the routine of life continues even when we upset our Creator. Our performance is not related to his love for us. His love for us is so great because God don't make no junk. He knows the true value of his creation. Even when we mess up big time, he's going to wait it out because he's going to say, I didn't make no junk. You have the power within from the choices you can do to turn your own life around and those of others. I'm going to hold out. God tells us the routine of marriage continues no matter what. Even if, God forbid, there are big differences, but to then say, right, no bedroom that's not right. I shouldn't do that. That's not right to hold back from that area. Why not? I'm angry. Oh, if I'm angry, I'm not going to be intimate. But don't hold that back, because the routine of a marriage must continue, because it's the virtue. That if I start playing around with intrinsic virtues, I am destroying the fabric of the relationship. A husband has to go to work. That's taking responsibility in the family. And a husband who doesn't is considered a bum. If he's not going to take responsibility, the contract says, the marriage Jewish contract says, a husband has to go to work. The routine of marriage continues. The power of the intrinsic virtues are there, so that even though we have differences, the intimacy continues. Getting a PhD in apology is the most important degree we could ever attain. To admit my mistakes to my spouse, even in front of the children sometimes. The kids have to see that dad or mom are making peace. And what a reference in their own lives that provides, that even if my spouse, when I get married, is not like me in every way, when we do have a difference, the possibility of shalom, of opposing forces coming together, is still real. I saw it in my own home. I saw dad apologize. I saw mum and dad appease each other. The routine of marriage, feeding each other, the meals, buying clothes, buying gifts, buying diamond rings, buying flowers. The routine of marriage continues despite the differences, because the differences are not what's going to make the marriage work or not. I'll ask the honest question. Is it how similar a husband and wife are and how less different they are that will make a happy marriage? Or is it how well we manage the differences? Because let's face it, do we know what differences are going to come between us at the chuppah? No, you don't know in the future. We have no idea what challenges are ahead, medically or financially or in relationships. We have no idea how mum might interfere or not interfere. We have no idea what changes in a career or location to a different community could bring between us. It's not the differences that's going to make or break the marriage. It's how loving, respectful we are about the differences, how powerful the sharp words, or the sympathy and the empathy and the understanding, and it's never too late to turn on to the real version. Because we don't change people by trying to change them. We change them by changing ourselves. And now you're not responding to the same person. You're going to respond to a different person. There's more to say on each one of these, but I need to close. I'm going to get on to love of parents. Love of parents. They brought us into this world. How much is that worth? Everything. No wonder the Torah tells us, honor mom and dad. Unconditionally, I owe them. Because I'm alive, because of you. Even though you met dad, you messed me up big time. Almost as much as mum. I am so angry. My parents messed me up. If it weren't for my parents, I'd be functional today. I would be so screwed up in my finances. My marriage wouldn't be such a mess. It's because of my parents. Now, I can blame my parents. I can accuse. A, accuse. B, blame. C, complain. D, deny that it's my fault on any level. And E, give excuses. The A, B, C, D, E of avoiding personal growth. Avoiding taking responsibility. I'll accuse you and blame you and complain about you and deny that it's my fault, it's yours, and give excuses why I didn't fall through, I didn't come through. And as long as I can blame someone outside of me, they have to change. You have to take responsibility, and then I'll be loving. No! Blaming my parents won't get me anywhere, except big bills over 10, 15 years of analyzing where I come from. But I gotta move forward. I gotta move forward. My parents, even if I can't get along well with them, I owe them intrinsic respect, intrinsic love, for one fact: they brought me into the world. No matter what mistakes they made after that, I owe them. Bottom line. Extended family. Extended family is very difficult to swallow. Abraham did not get along well with his nephew, who was also his brother-in-law, Lot. Lot, we're told, I think it's in chapter 13 in Genesis, did not display the same level of integrity as Abraham. So Abraham offered, Lot, you go in any direction you want, I'll go in the other direction. I'll always be there for you, but we can't get along anymore. Sometimes divorce is a reality. Sometimes breaking up is a reality. But in that reality, there's still an intrinsic love. Really? Yes. Because what did Abraham do in chapter 14 when Lot was captured? He put his life on the line to save a member of the extended family. Because family, by definition, means loyalty, devotion, irrespective of values, irrespective of how religious or not, irrespective of do I agree with your politics or your lifestyle. No, it's intrinsic to the fact that we're family. Let me ask you, what would happen if we didn't pay out any checks to any other community funds? In the community or outside the community, only to those who are members of our family and extended family. What would happen to the whole world if all our dollars only went first to family and extended family? I imagine a lot of the institutions that are there to help the needy would close. Intrinsic love for family is not related to performance. Who you are, how you behave, how you dress. How Jewish, how not Jewish, it's dependent on one thing. You're a member of my family, I owe you. You're my brother, you're my sister, your extended family. And love of friends and neighbors, and I'm going to close. Love of friends and neighbors, loving others, our friends and neighbors, which direction is it going in? Is it this direction or is it to get back? Because let's ask ourselves the honest question, who gets the most love? Who gets the most appreciation? The one who gives the most appreciation, the one who gives the most. When a person is loving in their friendships, in their neighbors, extended family, what happens when they're in trouble? Those who have benefited and received want to help out. And what happens when our children are in trouble, but we in our lifetime did our best to help others? Those others will be there for our children. And what happened when I estranged people in my life, even those closest to me, and then I need others? I'll end up in a home, or I'll end up very lonely. Giving and loving others is not just about giving and loving others. It's investing in our own future and those who are dependent on us when we won't be there for them. There's again so much more to say on all this, but time has kind of run out, and I will end off on the following. There were once three mothers. Mrs. Kuschlewski! And Mrs. Horowitz and Mrs. Cohen, and they're each boasting how much their son gives them respect on their birthday. You've heard this one, sir? No? Don't worry. If you've heard it, the way I say it is funny anyway. Just being honest. Mrs. Kuschlewski is telling Mrs. Horowitz, you want I should tell you how much my son loves me? Oh, you know how much respect he has. I should tell you what he does for me on my birthday. You don't want to know, but I tell you anyway. My son on my birthday, I hear a knock on the door, opens the door. Oh, my son! Mom, happy birthday! Just give me a hug, I think he's going to destroy my ribs. I open my eyes, at the end of the corridor, the lawn, I see this limousine stretch, how they stretch this limo. He takes me into the limousine, and he takes me to the most expensive kosher restaurant in Manhattan. And there in the restaurant waiting for me, all my friends and family. So my birthday party is so special. It's my son and my birthday. And Mrs. Horowitz, how does your son show you respect on your birthday? Oh, you don't want to know. But I tell you anyway. My son on my birthday, oh, he takes me in a taxi to JFK. And he puts me on the Concorde. And 2 hours and 47 minutes later, I arrive in London. And there he taxis me to the Ritz Hotel. The Ritz Hotel, this is for kings and queens, and he takes me to the Ritz Hotel. I arrive at the Ritz Hotel, and waiting for me there, all my friends and relatives from the whole world. This is my son, and my bus is so special. And they both turn to Mrs. Cohen, and everyone knows, has no relationship with her son. Zero, minus relationship. They have been talking for years. And Mrs. Cohen, how does your son show you respect on your birthday? Oh! My son, he doesn't have to wait for no birthday to show me respect. My son pays $200 an hour 5 times a week to his therapist, and all he talks about is me. Loving our spouse, loving our children with a simple smile. The smile says, I'm happy you're in my life. Loving our children with a kiss, loving our spouse with a kiss, a hug. It's a demonstration, it's a message. I want to penetrate, I want to get inside of you. When we listen to each other, it's even deeper than a hug and a kiss. Because the hug and kiss is an attempt for the body kind of to merge and get inside, and we can't get closer. But listening is listening to what's in your heart and mind, and I'm giving you my ears because I want what's in your heart and mind to enter my heart and mind, sharing, talking about each other's sorrows and aspirations and joys. This is really powerful love. Love is giving appreciation. Smiles, kisses and hugs. Giving appreciation for the virtues that are intrinsic to the other person. And even if, God forbid, we made a lot of mistakes and our kids had to go to a therapist for 10-15 years to get a healing relationship with me, it's still not too late, because I can change who I am in my relationship to that child, to that spouse, to that member of the extended family. And when I change myself, I change how you love me. Thank you for your patience. Yes.
Correct me if I'm wrong. You said that before it says that we have to love our parents unconditionally. But I always thought that we have to respect and honor our parents, but they have to earn our love.
Question. Excellent question. It says in chapter 20 in Exodus, Kabet et avicha ve'et imecha. You shall honor your father and your mother. But love, it doesn't say there. Surely they have that they have to earn. Now, we actually have a separate instruction. It's in Leviticus 19, verse 18. Ve'ahavta le'reacha kamocha. Love your neighbor as yourself. There, the love that's required of us is for every single person. So that's including our parents. Okay? So it really... Now, you are right. You are right that for a parent to really get the child to love them or even respect them, I do have to earn it, it's true. But what we're bringing home tonight is that there's reasons for intrinsic love and intrinsic respect, even in a relationship where there's a lot of differences. That's the main message tonight, that the differences can be forced to change because the power of real love, Ahava dochet hakol. Real love has the power to turn anything around, to change anything, to force anything. Very powerful formula from our sages. Thank you for your patience. Thank you. Thank you.